Have you ever felt like no matter how much you rest, you're still just running on empty? Fatigue, brain fog, even brittle nails, those can all be signs of iron deficiency. And here's the thing, iron deficiency is way more common than people realize. It affects about 1 in 3 adults, especially women, and traditional iron supplements usually don't cut it. They're hard to absorb, and they often leave you dealing with nausea, constipation, or a metallic-y taste. That's why I recommend Siderol from PharmaNutra. Siderol is a premium iron supplement made with patented sucrosomial technology, which basically wraps the iron in a protective shield so your body can absorb it 3 to 4 times better than standard iron. And the best part is it's gentle on the stomach. There's no nausea, no constipation, and no metallic taste. Siderol has been clinically studied, over 150 published studies, in fact, and it's trusted by more than 2 million people worldwide. It's Italy's number one supplement brand and is finally available here in the U.S. Just one capsule a day with water anytime, with or without food, and you're good to go. So if you're nodding along because you're exhausted, foggy, or just tired of feeling tired, this could be exactly what you've been missing. Head to pharmanutra-us.com and use the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 10% off your first order of Siderol. That's PHARMANUTRA-US.com with the code MAMA, M-A-M-A, for 10% off today. Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A.
And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit progressive.com to see what you can save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Learning through play starts with Lego Duplo. With Lego Duplo, toddlers can develop real-life skills while having fun with colorful bricks made just for them. Large, easy to grip, and safe to explore. When children express themselves with Lego Duplo, they build patience, problem-solving, and empathy. See your child learn perseverance and self-expression with everything they imagine and create. Visit lego.com/preschool to learn more.
When life brings the blah, add more Yabba Dabba Doo with some tasty fruity pebbles. Early morning meeting. Blah. Someone brought the pebbles? Yabba Dabba Doo. Run errands? Blah. Head to the store for pebbles. Yabba Dabba Doo. Fruity pebbles, less blah, more Yabba Dabba Doo. Pick up Pebbles cereal today.
Yabba Dabba Doo and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements, copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is going to be a little bit different than what we typically do. Today's episode is going to be a deep dive on the Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni lawsuits. Now, when Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni signed on to adapt Colleen Hoover's best-selling novel, It Ends With Us, no one expected it to ignite one of Hollywood's most shocking legal battles. And what started as a highly anticipated film adaptation about domestic violence has now spiraled into this war of lawsuits, social manipulation allegations, PR disasters, and an ugly behind-the-scenes power struggle. But how did we get here? And who, if anyone, is telling the truth? Well, I have read through the lawsuits, and I am here to break down the entire saga chronologically, factually, and with every key detail intact. This is likely going to be a two-parter. Just for reference, my episodes are typically, when I write the script for the episodes, they're typically like 6 pages long. This one is 20. So buckle up. We're going to be here for a while. If I'm joining you on your car ride, or if you're cleaning, or if you're doing whatever, you're rocking your baby to sleep, allow me to be your tour guide on the next probably at least hour of this Hollywood drama. And as always, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. Let me know what you think after you've given it a listen. Leave a review, share it with your friends, do all the things. Or should I say, grab your girlfriends, grab your florals, and sit down and listen. All right, let's get into it. So we're starting back in 2019 when actor turned director Justin Baldoni, best known for playing Raphael on Jane the Virgin, acquired the film rights to Colleen Hoover's breakout novel, It Ends With Us. A self-proclaimed advocate for gender equality, Justin Baldoni has built his brand on male allyship, producing documentaries and hosting a podcast called Man Enough, which explored masculinity and social justice. I think he also has a book by the same name, but all of his whole persona is all about, you know, like the toxic masculinity and combating that, right? So for Baldoni, It Ends With Us was more than just a romance. It was an opportunity to start a difficult conversation about domestic violence. Now, the book, if you haven't read it, it follows the main character, Lily Bloom, who is a woman caught between her abusive but loving husband, Ryle Kincaid, and her first love, Atlas Corrigan, who returns to her life at a pivotal moment. And with 4 million copies, or probably more than that now, sold, the novel had become this obsessive online fandom, particularly among young women on TikTok's BookTok community. So it's really important to note the target audience for this book and this movie is women under the age of 35. Now, Colleen Hoover and Justin Baldoni began communicating through email about this adaptation back in January of 2019 and into April. And Justin said in part in one of his emails, "I haven't been able to get It Ends With Us out of my mind. Such an important story. So damn romantic and beautiful and tragic and hopeful. I always say that both in art and life, all the best stories are always two things at once, and this is so much what your book is. Joy and pain. Love and sorrow." And then he goes on to acknowledge the rawness of her book and what the ultimate message is, which is essentially breaking the cycles of domestic violence. Now, Colleen seemed to really appreciate this at the time, saying in part, "You get the book, and that's the most important thing to me. My big fear is that I'll option it to someone who thinks it's a hot romance, and they'll take it in the absolute wrong direction." A month later, on May 8th of 2019, Justin options the book It Ends With Us from Colleen Hoover, meaning that Justin secured the exclusive rights to develop the book into a film for a specific period of time. So if he makes the film happen within that time frame, I think it's usually like 5 years, then great, he gets the rights to it. If not, then Colleen gets the option to give it to someone else. So Justin envisioned this powerful, raw adaptation staying as faithful to the novel's dark emotional themes as possible. And Sony Pictures signed on as the distributor, and Wayfarer Studios, which is Justin Baldoni's production company, took creative control. But one major decision would shift the trajectory of the film and Justin Baldoni's entire career. On December 31st of 2022, Blake Lively agrees to take the lead role of Lily Bloom. Now, Hollywood casting decisions can sometimes be polarizing, but when Blake Lively was announced as Lily Bloom, the internet erupted. At 36, Blake Lively was significantly older than the 23-year-old character that she was playing, prompting complaints that the film was aging up the story's protagonist. And book fans also questioned her blonde hair, as Lily is known in the book for her red hair. However, Blake Lively wasn't just the star. She was given executive producer status, granting her direct influence over creative decisions. Now, these decisions, casting a 36-year-old to play a 23-year-old, in addition to giving her these privileges, were probably the first of many decisions that Justin regrets now. At first, Blake and Justin appeared to be aligned, and a lot of their communication was very, you know, jovial and friendly. But sources suggest that she hadn't actually read the book before she signed on, and as she immersed herself in this project, she began pushing for changes that really conflicted with Justin Baldoni's vision and with the accuracy of the book. So from the beginning of production, Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni had starkly different versions of It Ends With Us in their minds. What started as minor disagreements quickly snowballed into a full-scale power struggle, one that ultimately reshaped the entire film. It led to internal disputes, and it set the stage for lawsuits that soon followed. Now, at its core, the battle for creative control centered on three key issues: the portrayal of domestic violence, Blake Lively's desire for script rewrites and wardrobe changes, and Justin Baldoni's insistence on staying faithful to Colleen Hoover's novel. When Blake Lively signed on as both the film's lead and an executive producer, she gained influence over the direction of the story. However, sources close to the production claim that she hadn't actually read the book before she accepted this role, which was a claim that Blake herself alluded to in interviews when she admitted that she didn't know much about the book prior to joining. Now, once she finally delved into the story, she reportedly became uncomfortable with the darker themes, particularly the raw depiction of domestic abuse and Lily's initial acceptance of Ryle Kincaid's behavior, and also the way that Hoover's novel framed Lily's journey as painful rather than empowering. Blake seemed to want this, she seemed to want this book to be this female empowerment, you know, I am woman, hear me roar type of book. And that's really not what the book was. If you read it, you would have known that. So according to insiders, Blake pushed for a revised version of Lily Bloom, one that focused more on resilience and less on victimhood. So her proposed changes included things like softening the intensity of Ryle's abuse, rewriting key emotional scenes to emphasize Lily's strength rather than her internal conflict, and removing certain moments that she deemed too distressing for mainstream audiences. So what I think when I hear those things is she wanted this to be just a fluffy Hollywood piece, which is really what I think a lot of people are kind of sick of when it comes to these like basic Hollywood films. They all kind of follow the same theme. None of them really seem to be like deep and thought-provoking. And, you know, that's what Colleen's book was intended to do, was to kind of show the painful reality of relationships that have domestic abuse and how you kind of get trapped in this cycle, you know. And there's, it's so often, as someone who hosts a true crime podcast, it's so often we cover these stories of domestic violence and people wonder, why didn't the girl just leave? Why didn't she leave? Why didn't the victim just leave? Well, it's so much deeper than that. And once you get caught into this snowball, you know, it's a lot harder to get out of it than you realize. And I think that's what the book and Justin were really trying to tell in this book or in this movie. And so by Blake coming in and saying, well, we need to soften Ryle's abuse and let's focus on Lily's strength rather than her internal conflict. Like, you're doing such a disservice to actual victims of domestic violence, right? So Blake reportedly argued that a Hollywood adaptation of the novel needed to be more digestible, fearing that a brutally honest portrayal of domestic violence might alienate general audiences. Now, one in four women over the age of, I believe, 25 have experienced severe domestic violence. And now that's just experiencing domestic violence. That's not talking about the people who are close to people who have experienced it, right? So to kind of dumb down this entire experience so that it's more digestible for your Hollywood audience is really kind of insulting to me. Like, do you not think that I'm smart enough or empathetic enough to understand a serious message in a movie? So naturally, this vision put her directly at odds with Justin Baldoni, who believed the story should remain as emotionally raw as possible and true to the book that he did read. And in 2019, in those emails with Colleen, she, the author of the book, seemed like she was very aligned with Justin. She even said, you know, that she could see him playing Ryle and, you know, kind of pushed for that. Now, Justin saw It Ends With Us as more than just a romance turned drama. He viewed it as a crucial commentary on domestic violence. Unlike Blake Lively, Justin had been attached to the project for years, long before it became a major Hollywood production. He personally acquired the rights in 2019, which was also long before TikTok's Book Talk catapulted the novel into mainstream popularity. And this is going to come full circle. The fact that he has the rights to the novel will come full circle. And I will explain this towards the end, or maybe in part two, depending on how long this takes. So just stay with me because it all makes sense. But Justin had a clear vision from the start. The adaptation needed to reflect the full emotional complexity of Colleen's book. Nothing should be sugar-coated or toned down. And the film had to remain true to Lily's experience as a survivor. Now, to ensure accuracy, Justin brought on consultants from the No More Foundation, an organization dedicated to raising awareness about domestic violence and sexual assault. He wanted the audience to really sit with the discomfort, to feel the pain, fear, and confusion that survivors often experience. Justin's goal, as he later stated, was to ensure that if a real-life Lily Bloom watches this movie, she might recognize herself and then make a different choice for herself. So when Blake Lively began advocating for major changes to soften the material, Justin resisted, leading to the first major on-set clashes. So one of the first major fights between Blake and Justin came during rehearsals for one of the novel's most pivotal moments, which is the confrontation between Lily and Ryle after his first act of violence. So in the book, this scene is brutal and it's heartbreaking. Lily doesn't immediately walk away. Instead, she kind of struggles with her emotions. She starts making excuses for Ryle's behavior, and she has a hard time believing that Ryle could be capable of hurting her, right? So Justin Baldoni wanted the scene to reflect the psychological turmoil that many survivors go through, the self-doubt, the gaslighting, and the moments of denial. But Blake reportedly pushed back, arguing that the scene made Lily seem weak, and she proposed rewriting the dialogue so that Lily immediately asserts herself and stands up to Ryle rather than grappling with the emotional weight of the moment. And that, to me, just tells me that Blake is so disconnected from reality or disconnected from the subject matter of this book and this movie that she really should have just sat this one out. But regardless, Justin Baldoni flat out refused, allegedly telling Blake Lively that Lily's strength isn't in how quickly she fights back, it's in how she survives. So this disagreement allegedly delayed production for over a week as both sides refused to compromise. And then finally, Sony executives were brought in to mediate, forcing Justin Baldoni to make some minor concessions, though the scene ultimately remained closer to its original version. Another heated dispute revolved around Lily Bloom's wardrobe. So Justin Baldoni, following Hoover's book, wanted Lily's clothing to reflect her growth and her transformation throughout the story. So at the beginning, her outfits would be soft and floral and light, representing her hopeful, romanticized view of love. And then as the film progressed and the abuse escalated, her wardrobe would subtly change with more muted tones, heavier fabrics, a visual representation of Lily's emotional weight, and maybe even a way to hide the bruising on her body from the abuse. However, Blake Lively had a completely different version. She reportedly insisted on choosing her own wardrobe, disregarding the costume designer's original plans. And this decision led to the now infamous paparazzi photos of Blake Lively in this oversized, outdated-looking brown coat, which sparked widespread online backlash. Fans ridiculed the outfit, saying that it looked cheap, uninspired, and completely unflattering. And yet many blamed Justin Baldoni for the film's apparent low-budget aesthetic, not knowing at the time that Blake was the one overruling the costume designer. But behind the scenes, Justin and the costume team were really frustrated. When the backlash hit, Justin allegedly confronted Blake, arguing that her wardrobe choices were harming the film's credibility. So then Blake, in turn, accuses Justin Baldoni of being overly controlling and trying to dictate how she should present herself on screen. This confrontation reportedly, so you can take it with a grain of salt anytime I say reportedly, led to a screaming match between the two, witnessed by multiple crew members. Apparently, Sony had to intervene again, but by that point, the damage was already done. The first cracks in the production were becoming impossible to ignore. So the final major battle over creative control came toward the end of production, before they started filming, when Blake Lively reportedly wanted to rewrite the film's ending. So in It Ends With Us, Lily ultimately chooses to walk away from Ryle, breaking the cycle of abuse and choosing herself. However, Blake pushed for a more ambiguous ending, one where Lily's final decision is left open-ended. So Justin vehemently opposed this, arguing that Lily's decision was the most important part of the entire story. It wasn't just about her love life, but about breaking free from generational trauma. So sources say that this was the final breaking point between the two. And after this, Justin began pulling back from the project's marketing efforts, while Blake took the lead in shaping how the film was presented to the public. But before we get to that point, because I'm going to break down exactly how they got to that point, I want to stay chronological. So let's move on to the onset allegations. So by the time It Ends With Us entered full-scale production, tensions between Blake and Justin had already reached a breaking point over creative control, but what happened on set would escalate the conflict even further, leading to accusations of sexual harassment, workplace misconduct, and an eventual legal battle. Now, the core allegations that emerged from Blake's lawsuit painted a disturbing picture of what she described as a hostile, unsafe work environment. And these include alleged inappropriate comments made by Justin Baldoni, uncomfortable physical interactions during intimate scenes, unwanted conversations about Blake's appearance and her post-baby body, and instances where Justin allegedly overstepped personal and professional boundaries. And I will elaborate on those. But Justin denied all of these allegations, insisting that Blake weaponized false claims to damage his reputation and gain power over the production. So his countersuit, filed 1 month after Blake's, framed the allegations as part of a calculated PR strategy designed to push him out of the film's promotional campaign. And in that lawsuit, it is all explicitly laid out with receipts. So let's get into the receipts so that we can surmise what really happened and who, if anyone, is telling the truth. The first signs of trouble emerged as soon as filming began in May of 2023. According to sources who later spoke to The Hollywood Reporter, the atmosphere on set was noticeably tense, with heated arguments between Blake and Justin occurring in front of crew members regularly. One assistant director, who spoke on condition of anonymity, described the dynamic as awkward and uncomfortable, adding, quote, "It was clear from day one that they didn't trust each other. Blake was questioning Justin's decisions. Justin was getting frustrated with Blake. You could feel the tension in every interaction," end quote. Crew members also reported moments where Blake seemed visibly upset, particularly after rehearsing certain scenes with Justin. At the time, many dismissed it as standard on-set disagreements between an actor and a director deeply immersed in this emotional role. However, Blake's December 2024 lawsuit later revealed that these early tensions were rooted in far more serious concerns. One of the most shocking claims that Blake made in her lawsuit revolved around how Justin handled intimate scenes between their characters, Lily and Ryle. Blake alleged that Justin ignored industry protocols for filming scenes of a romantic or intimate nature. She claims that despite the presence of an intimacy coordinator, Justin pressured her into moments of improvisation that she did not consent to. One particular onset incident became a major point of contention in her legal filing, which is the lip-biting incident. Blake alleged that during the filming of this bedroom scene, Baldoni bit on her lip and sucked on it, which was an action that was not in the script or discussed beforehand. So her lawsuit states, quote, "At no point was physical intimacy of this nature agreed upon, rehearsed, or sanctioned. The defendant's actions violated industry standards and created an unsafe and unprofessional work environment," end quote. Now, this reportedly led to an on-set confrontation with Blake storming off set and demanding that production be halted. And according to two anonymous crew members who spoke to Deadline, Justin was confused by Blake's reaction, insisting that he had just been trying to create a more natural, raw moment in the scene. One crew member allegedly recalled Justin kept saying, "I thought it worked for the scene. I thought we were in the moment." Now, despite Justin's insistence that he had done nothing wrong, production was paused for several hours while Sony executives mediated the dispute. And then ultimately, Justin agreed to reshoot the scene without the unplanned physical contact, but this incident permanently fractured his working relationship with Blake, according to Blake. Now, her lawsuit also claims that Justin engaged in repeated unwanted conversations about her personal life, specifically her appearance and post-baby body. One of her key claims was that she alleged Justin repeatedly commented on her weight and appearance, particularly in relation to the film's wardrobe decisions. And then according to her lawsuit, Justin questioned her about her post-baby fitness regimen and made remarks about how pregnancy had changed her body. And she claims that Justin said things like, "We want Lily to look vulnerable but still desirable. Have you thought about toning up a little?" Now, let's talk about this point real quick, because Justin had provided some pretty damning receipts suggesting that she is, in fact, twisting the truth here. So on January 22nd of 2023, Blake Lively introduced Justin to her friend and personal trainer, who would later become Justin's personal trainer also, and he provided screenshots of text messages with this personal trainer. Justin has a back injury that he has to be very careful not to re-injure himself, right? So when he was speaking to his trainer about this one particular scene where he has to lift Blake up and then place her on a bed, he wanted to make sure that he trained properly so that he could do that safely for him and safely for Blake. But she took that as, "Why are you even asking about my weight?" or "Why are you even talking about my weight?" like completely spun it into something else. Then on February 9th, Blake and Justin exchange text messages, and she jokes with Justin that she is 20 pounds from her goal weight. And Justin responds by disliking that message. And then Blake thanks Justin for his friendship and his support. The following week, Justin begins writing and sending script revisions to Blake, and their conversations are pretty chummy. Justin says, "You know, been deep into writing, really fun with you in mind." Not fun, right word, exciting. And she responds with a happy face emoji and praying hands and says, "You're safe here." And he responds with a red heart. And then a few days later, Blake reaches out and asks if they can push back the intimate slash body scenes towards the end of their filming schedule so that she can have more time to tone up since she just had a baby. So she sends this long message because this girl loves to type. And she says in part, quote, "As woke as we both are and work to be, this movie requires a certain aesthetic. It's not always part of the job, but on this one it is, and that's great. And as much as I'd love to not think about it, that would be irresponsible and also impossible because it's unrealistic to not acknowledge what I need to do," end quote. Now he responds so kindly saying, quote, "I want you to know you will look amazing. Anything you are insecure about, we will talk through and get creative together and make sure you're comfortable. I just don't want you to stress about your body. It's the last thing you need," end quote. Then Justin's trainer sends him his workout program on February 26th. So a month later, after that, on March 29th, Lively shares with Justin that she has strep throat, and Justin offers to send her some amazing gut health protocols that help after antibiotics. Blake responds, please. As a result, Justin reaches out to his board-certified integrative holistic health coach, that is a mouthful, and connects them. Blake shares that they connected, saying she's incredible, and then Blake later claimed in her CRD complaint that his, quote, health coach was actually a weight loss specialist and that this was all just a ruse for Justin to subtly fat shame her. Now, throughout the lawsuit and the timeline, like, the mix of it all, I just want to point out that Blake gets sick often. She has strep 3 times in 1 month, and then she gets COVID. And then, so she's just like constantly missing work, and she's sick, and her kids are sick, and everything. It's, you know, it is what it is. But Justin is never anything but just supportive and wishing her well and offering to help however he can. I see that in the text messages. And I also want to note that in the text messages that Justin has sent, there is nothing redacted other than like specific names. But in Blake's lawsuit, all of the text messages that she provides are all just a screenshot of singular messages. It leaves out any context of conversation before the text or after the text. So she quite literally cherry-picked messages that maybe you could misconstrue without context, but in Justin's response to all of her claims in her lawsuit, he includes so many screenshots. I mean, the lawsuit itself is like 170 pages, and probably a third of those are screenshots. So on April 5th, Justin texts Blake saying that he has hired an intimacy coordinator and can set up a time for Blake to meet her the following week. But Blake says, I'm good, I can just meet her when we start. So she doesn't care to actually sit down with this person and discuss what they both expect out of these scenes or what their goal is, nothing. So Justin is like, okay, I'll meet with her, I'll take notes, and we can go over the notes together before we, you know, start on production. So on April 7th, Blake asks if she can take a pass at rewriting the rooftop scene when Lily and Ryle meet for the first time. Obviously, this is a very integral part of the movie and the book, and she essentially wants to put her chummy, ball-busting flair on it. And I swear, I feel like Blake and Ryan Reynolds think that they are the only two people on the planet who really get how to make a modern meet-cute scene. But regardless, Justin appeases her, and she says, quote, if you knew me in person longer, you'd have a sense of how flirty and yummy the ball-busting would play. It's my love language. Spicy and playfully bold, never with teeth, and him serving it back to her is just as important. You don't usually see both the man and the woman with such agency and humor. I am sorry, but there are plenty of funny women out there. And so to say, like, you don't usually see both a man and a woman with such agency and humor, it's like, how dumb do you think your audience is that they can't digest a movie about domestic violence and that they can't possibly imagine a woman being funny in a role? Like, I don't know. I just feel like she sits herself on such a high pedestal as this, you know, producer of films that, you know, really rule Hollywood, and that she and Ryan are probably the end all be all to all successful movies. Like, I don't know. I just feel like we've seen this a lot. We've seen this same kind of story play out. I would like to see something a little more cerebral. So maybe you're not meant for this role. Because she keeps wanting to make it like a rom-com. It's not a rom-com, Blake. It's a movie about domestic violence. So anyway, Justin gets the rewritten scene and tells her that he loves it. He appreciates her passion and that the final edit will probably be a blend of Blake's vision and Justin's vision, which is a compromise, right? Mm-hmm. Wrong. Compromise is not a word that exists in Blake's vocabulary. So 3 days later, Justin is invited to Blake and Ryan's New York City apartment to discuss the script and Blake's rewrite. Ryan is, of course, praising her rewrite, and then in walks none other than Blake's bestie, Taylor Swift, who also apparently read the rewrite and is praising it for being so amazing. But apparently during that meeting, Justin kind of backed down and caved to the pressure, so Blake sent him the exceedingly long Dragons text. Now, to summarize, because you guys, this text is very long, the text says in part, quote, as for, redacted, I'm assuming, Taylor and Ryan, I'm the luckiest motherfucker on the planet to have them as my dance moms level stage moms. They are embarrassingly effusive. That said, they're also my most trusted partners and the people I go to first with anything creative I touch. And I'm the first person they go to first. That reciprocal creativity and support has been one of my life's greatest and most fulfilling gifts. And then she says, I think they wanted you and me to see how they felt about the work because they've been by my side for far too many experiences where I've been overlooked. I spoke to you about this when we first met. Now, I personally feel like that is very manipulative to suggest that Justin could be lumped into the same category simply because he, as the director, chooses not to use 100% of what her, you know, rewrite is. To say that, like, oh, I've been overlooked in the past. Why? Because you were told no a few times or because they wanted to compromise? Like, it very much seems like it's Blake's way or the highway here and as we go on. But both Ryan, she continues to say, quote, both Ryan and T have established themselves as absolute titans, as writers and storytellers outside of their primary gig, just singing or just acting. I'm so lucky to have them as creative barometers. Blah, 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 more word vomit. And then finally she says, if you ever get around to watching Game of Thrones, you'll appreciate that I'm Khaleesi. And like her, I happen to have a few dragons, for better or worse, but usually for the better, because my dragons also protect those I fight for. So really, we all benefit from those gorgeous monsters of mine. You will too, I can promise you. Which, as cringy as that is, it also feels kind of like a thinly veiled threat. Like, they are my monsters and I keep them by my side. And while they support and lift me up, they'll tear you down as well. Or they'll protect you, just depending on what kind of choice you make, right? Like, that's the vibe that I get from it. But Justin followed up with this voice note, as promised, responding to her text about dragons and expressed his sincere apologies for not being more sensitive to her feelings and when responding to her notes on the rooftop scene. He also acknowledged how lucky she is to have her husband and friends as her supporters. He spends a considerable amount of time encouraging her and basically kissing her ass and assuring her that she is valued. And the thing about Justin, like, and you'll see this as a pattern, okay? If you look at the lawsuits yourself, you'll see this pattern of Blake being this demanding brat and diva, and then Justin being this complete pushover, this guy that is so, so sensitive and in tune with his feelings and everyone else's feelings, that she just completely walks all over him. And it's frustrating even to see Justin not stand up for himself a little bit more, but you have to understand too, and I understand, he's just a very sensitive guy and he's not trying to upset anyone. He values women probably more than anything else on the planet. But it seems like Blake is really taking advantage of that. And the craziest thing about all of this is that at this point, filming has not even started yet. They are still in production, script writing, working out all those details, rehearsing, etc. So April 20th, Jamie Heath, who is a co-founder of Wayfarer Productions and a producer on this film, and I think he and Justin are also very close, Jamie gets a text from one of the producers, and the producer says to Jamie, quote, he cannot let her have opinions on everything or she's going to be co-directing this film. Jamie says, Blake? And the producer says, yes. Jamie says, quote, yeah, we were talking about that a lot yesterday. Producer says, exactly. This is why everyone is starting to lose it. We have been talking about the same thing for months. Jamie says, quote, yep, it's starting to get resolved. And the producer says, quote, no, it's not.
With a Venmo debit card, you can Venmo more than just your friends. You can use your balance in so many ways. You can Venmo everything. Need gas? You can Venmo this. How about snacks? You can Venmo that. Your favorite band's merch? You can Venmo this. Or their next show? You can Venmo that. Visit Venmo.me/debit to learn more.
You can Venmo this, or you can Venmo that. You can Venmo this, or you can Venmo that.
The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated. Card may be used everywhere MasterCard is accepted. Venmo purchase restrictions apply.
It's summer. Time to enjoy long days, lazy nights, and great food. Because Uber Eats has deals all summer long. So, when hunger strikes, don't sweat it. Delicious deals are just a tap away on Uber Eats. Enjoy all your favorite grocery items delivered straight to you. Get ice cream, soda, and snacks from your favorite stores like Wegmans and CVS and make the most of every moment. Now that sounds like a good summer. Order now on Uber Eats. Terms apply. Product availability varies by region. See app for details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Now, before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is ZBiotics. Now, let's face it. There's no diet out there that is perfectly balanced. Either I'm eating too much of this or not enough of that. And that is why I started using the sugar to fiber probiotic mix every day. The PhD microbiologists over at ZBiotics understand that sugar is all but impossible to avoid these days. And 95% of Americans do not get enough fiber. So they genetically engineered a probiotic to convert some of the extra sugar from our everyday diet into a prebiotic fiber called Levan. Their sugar-to-fiber packets produce an enzyme called Levan sucrase to break down the sugar into its molecular building blocks, and then it stacks those blocks together to make fiber. So this leads to a more balanced microbiome, the key to a healthy gut. One stick pack of sugar-to-fiber, and you will get a daily dose of fiber from the foods that you already eat. So I started drinking sugar-to-fiber every day because I like having a way to get closer to that daily recommended dose of fiber without needing to overhaul my entire diet. And I really like knowing that this fiber was coming from extra sugar I was already eating and didn't need. Now, in 2025, I am prioritizing my microbiome, and sugar to fiber is my daily insurance that I'm getting enough fiber. So go to zbiotics.com/mama and use the code MAMA at checkout for 15% off any first-time orders of ZBiotics probiotics. ZBiotics has a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for literally any reason, they will refund your money, no questions asked. Thank you so much to ZBiotics for sponsoring today's episode, and let's get back to the story. Now, remember when Justin hired the intimacy coordinator and Blake said that she was fine with just meeting her when they started filming? Well, Justin met with the intimacy coordinator and took notes and then went to Blake to share these notes. So on April 21st of 2023, Justin meets with the intimacy coordinator to discuss how to shoot the sex scenes. And it was important to him that the intimacy coordinator be a woman to help craft sex scenes that would speak to the book's mostly female audience. So his notes from this meeting were later shared with Blake during one of their script writing meetings at her New York apartment. And these notes would later become the basis for Blake's complaint, in which she states that Baldoni would talk about his own sex life and insert gratuitous sex scenes with Lively's character orgasming. Now, as seen in the notes, these mentions come directly from the intimacy coordinator's notes, saying, quote, goes down on her, orgasm, foreplay, the clit test. Sorry, I know these are really explicit, but ideally, these conversations would have taken place directly between Blake and the intimacy coordinator and Baldoni, as he requested. However, it was Blake that declined to meet with her, leaving Justin in this less than ideal position of having to relay these notes to Blake privately in her penthouse. So on April 22nd of 2023, in preparation for a lift sequence in which Justin's character Ryle would lift Lily, Justin reached out to his personal trainer, who was also a close friend of Blake's, to ask what Blake weighed so that he could train his back muscles for the scene. And this was important to avoid injury, not only to Justin, who has suffered from lifelong back injuries, like I mentioned earlier, he's had multiple bulging discs and chronic pain. At one point during, this was after filming, but he was actually hospitalized for days because of an infection in his spine. So obviously he's very concerned about his back, but also to Blake, because if the lift could not be completed successfully and safely, then there's no need to do it, right? Well, Blake would later claim in her complaint that this scene never existed. However, as evidenced by the script pages, which are included in Justin's lawsuit, and also a video in which Justin is rehearsing the scene with a body double, the scene was very real. But she was not going to mention that, because then it would compromise her argument that he was talking about her weight and fat shaming her. Well, no, again, you're leaving out important context. So now 3 days later, on April 25th, Justin was summoned by Blake to her penthouse, and he was greeted by Ryan Reynolds, who then swore at Justin and accused him of fat-shaming his wife, saying, "How dare you fucking ask about my wife's weight? What's wrong with you?" And the tone from Ryan Reynolds and Blake was so aggressive that Justin felt he had no choice but to offer repeated and completely unwarranted apologies for what was really a good faith and reasonable question to his trainer, not to Blake. But Ryan Reynolds demanded that Justin removed the lift scene entirely. So that is why it's not in the film anymore. Then that same day, an email goes out to the crew saying that the wardrobe has gone insanely over budget because of Blake's creative changes and that this producer had never seen a film go so over budget. So for clarity, the wardrobe budget for this film was $185,000. And usually they expect to spend, when they have that kind of budget, they expect to spend about $500,000 and then return the things that don't work. And after the returns, they whittle it back down to that $185,000 mark. Well, this producer said that at that point, they had spent $615,000 with plans to do returns that would hopefully get them back near the ballpark of $185,000. But with Blake's creative changes, she had overspent by at least $115,000. And I think this part is interesting because you also hear her in some of her interviews say, oh yeah, a lot of the clothes were mine because, you know, every small business owner has a pair of Louboutins in their closet. Like, that's totally normal. But anyway, she boasts that a lot of these pieces that she ended up wearing were actually from her own closet. So anyway, April 28th, Justin flies out to LA from New York with Blake and her family. And for the duration of the 6-hour flight, Justin and Lively work on the script together. Now, listen, if you are uncomfortable working with someone, do you think you're going to offer them to fly on your private plane with your family for 6 hours, like to and from? That's crazy. I feel like that probably wouldn't happen. But on April 30th, they then returned to New York together. And the next day, there is a text message thread that is a screenshot in the lawsuit, and it's from May 1st, so the day after they return from New York. The producer says, are you listening to this? She's fixing the script. I think, redacted, advice was actually wrong. Blake is now directing the movie. This is bad. Jamie Heath responds, I'm listening, talking it through. It is better than not, seeing what's possible, as long as any decision is done with approval. The producer responds, not for something that was already intimately planned. This will be every day of the shoot. Jamie says, I know. I'm not sure what can be done, honestly, at this point in terms of Blake. So obviously you see behind the scenes, well before we ever hear about any kind of drama, everyone is already talking behind the scenes about how Blake is the problem. And Blake is overexerting herself in positions and work-related tasks that do not belong to her. So the very next day, the Writers Guild of America goes on strike, halting the production of It Ends With Us. Filming finally begins on May 15th of 2023, and a paparazzi captured a photo of Blake as Lily. And in this picture, she's in this like brownish long skirt. It's like a, I don't even know how to describe it, you guys. It's ugly, other than that, okay? It's just an ugly brown skirt. She's got brown combat boots on, a pink, like, T-shirt that's tied at the side, and then a hot pink raincoat or jacket, I think. I don't know. The look is just awful. And fans of Colleen Hoover and the book immediately started poking fun at it left and right, saying things like, I never pictured her this homely. And then another quote that says, me, mom, I want Carrie Bradshaw. Mom, we have Carrie Bradshaw at home. And then in italics, the Carrie Bradshaw at home. Like, it's just not good. And the next day, Justin finally realizes he needs to stand up to Blake a little bit or this whole thing is going to be a disaster and she's going to pull it out from under him. She's taken control over almost everything and it's not manifesting in a positive way. So he texts Jamie Heath saying that he's going to go talk to her and he literally says, seeing her in 10, send me prayers. I'm just saying I've been ignoring my gut and there's a few things we need to course correct on. I'm fucking terrified of saying the wrong thing. Talk after. That is from Justin, okay? Apparently, the meeting didn't last too long. It was about an hour and a half, but Blake Lively's complaint falsely characterized that whole exchange as this lengthy outburst that delayed filming and caused the crew to wait around for hours while Justin cried in Blake's dressing room. And Justin did admit to becoming emotional a little bit during the conversation, but only in response to what he believed was a genuine compliment from Blake, praising his work as a director and an actor. Justin later realized that this was the first of very many manipulations by Blake, who in this moment was trying to convince Justin to continue her autonomy over her wardrobe. So the meeting essentially was a waste. May 17th, Blake continued to share her open and unguarded thoughts on Lily's life and wardrobe and sent a message to Justin regarding an outfit with a beanie. She says, quote, we'll show you both ways, but beanie is much sexier. It's the look. feels TV without, especially with a crop top in the snow. It justifies the rest of the skin. And also, as a girl, I would check out walking down the street because it washes the effort off the rest of the look. So Blake is using the word sexy, and I just want to reiterate that because she later claims that that word made her uncomfortable when Justin referred to the character that way. So we will get into that as well, but that is directly out of Blake's mouth. May 22nd, this is number six, the shoot day number six. On this day, Blake prepared to shoot the hospital scene in which her character Lily gives birth. Now, in Blake's December 20th complaint, she alleged that during a birthing scene, she was mostly nude with her legs spread wide in stirrups and only a small piece of fabric covering her genitalia, and that there were only non-essential persons present. Well, Justin's rebuttal to that is to describe Blake as mostly nude and naked from the chest down is inaccurate. He says Blake was wearing black briefs and a pregnancy suit that covered her midsection, and her top was covered by a hospital gown. Now, additionally, in Blake's complaint, she stated she was alarmed that Justin had hired his best friend to be the OBGYN of the scene. Well, the actor portraying the obstetrician is actually an award-winning Shakespearean-trained actor with an MFA in acting from UCLA. In addition to appearing on numerous hit TV shows, he has toured nationally with a Tony Award-winning acting company and attended Oxford's acting program on a full scholarship. His engagement was no different than the engagement of Lively's sister, who was hired because she is Lively's sister. And despite their personal relationship, they are both experienced and professional actors. But get this, the next day, Justin texts Blake saying, quote, "I'm not going to tell you that you were amazing because you tease me for being so sentimental, but you were amazing today," end quote. And she responds saying, quote, "Thank you. I do appreciate it. I'm just a ball buster, but it means a lot to me. I care a great deal and always want to deliver. You were terrific. I'm proud of everything we did today, but really every day," end quote. So that, of course, was not included in her complaint. But May 23rd, it is now the seventh day of shooting. Justin, during a scene in which the cast is wearing loose-fitting onesies, attempted to give Blake directorial feedback regarding a wardrobe and encourages her to remove her coat to reveal the onesie that matches the rest of the cast, who were also dressed in onesies. Now, in Blake's complaint, she alleged that Justin used the word sexy in a tone that made her feel ogled and exposed. I'm sorry, I can't, I just can't. Like, you can't be this ball-busting badass and then also complain about feeling ogled and exposed when you, in turn, are using the word sexy. Like, you can't have rules for everyone else and not yourself. But Justin, as the director, noted that the look would be sexy, referencing the wardrobe for the scene and not Lively personally. Now, Blake had previously mentioned verbally and in texts that she wanted her wardrobe to be sexy. So his statements were immediately followed by a gesture indicating that Blake had something in her teeth, and then a request for someone on set to get her a toothpick. Now, it's probably kind of embarrassing, but this exchange, all of which was captured on camera, was bookended by Justin's immediate recognition that Lively appeared offended. And Justin offered multiple apologies to Blake moments later, despite the fact that he was just doing his job. Later that day, during lunch, as part of a continued creative discussion that Justin and Blake were having about the hospital birthing scene, Justin asked Jamie Heath to show Blake his wife's post-home birth video, stating to Jamie that Blake had not seen one and was presumably interested in watching. So Justin himself had seen the video prior and felt it was demonstrative of the spirit of the vision for the birthing scene. So Jamie agreed to share this deeply personal video and approached Blake with the video in hand. And he proceeded to show her 1 second of it before Blake asked if Jamie even had permission to share that video, to which Jamie confirmed that he did. And then Blake stated that she would like to see the video, but asked if she could finish watching it after she eats lunch, which is fair. And Jamie did not press the matter and then moved on. But to note, Blake actually never did see the video beyond the 1 second clip that was shown to her. And the video in question showed Jamie and his wife cradling their newborn daughter post-birth, and notably, his wife was not in labor in the video. In fact, the video begins with the cries of the baby while she's resting on the mother's chest, and Jamie's wife remains covered with a towel for the duration of the video. She's submerged in water because this was like a tub birth, I guess. And she's holding her newborn. And there's screenshots of this on the internet if you want to see it. There's no nudity in it. It's not meant to be like that. It's just meant to be this, you know, depiction of a beautiful moment, right? But this entire interaction between Jamie and Blake lasted less than 30 seconds. But Blake Lively later likened this one-second clip to being pornography and stated that Jamie showed her, quote, a video of a fully nude woman with her legs spread apart. And in Justin's lawsuit, it says it best, so I'm just going to quote it directly, but it says the attempt to transform this benign event into an act of sexual misconduct is intentionally offensive. And to characterize a photo with a newborn baby as pornography is perverse. And I think that's absolutely right. She's blowing this way out of proportion. Now, apparently on the same day, May 23rd, this is days, what, seven of shooting, Blake and Justin filmed the now infamous romance montage. Now, Blake said in her original complaint that in this scene, Justin kissed her neck, even though it wasn't in the script, and then told her she smelled so good. But on January 21st of this year, Justin's attorney released the raw clip of that moment, and you can see the two laughing and acting in what is supposed to be this romantic moment. And you can hear the audio in it because the scene was intended to not have audio so everyone could just talk and be themselves because you weren't going to hear it anyway, right? And so in this scene, Justin runs his beard along her neck and collarbone, and he says, I'm getting beard on you today. And she says, I'm probably getting spray tan on you. And he says, it smells good. Because if you've ever had a spray tan, you know they can sometimes smell a little musty and they have this like distinct scent. Most of them do anyway. But she spun this moment into something sinister again to substantiate these claims that probably not expecting him to release the actual footage. But like, if you have the context, this is why I always say context matters, because if you were just hearing her side of it and you didn't have the footage to actually look at it, you might believe like that he was being weird or gross. But thankfully, we do have a lot of these raw clips that are saved because it's a movie, Blake. Like, did you not know that a lot of this was going to be recorded? I also want to point out, just as a side note, that I do follow some people on social media who initially were Team Blake in the beginning. And obviously, Brandon Sklenar also, you know, her co-host who played Atlas, also showed her complaint or shared it on his stories that said, like, for the love of God, please read this. And it was very much playing into this whole theme of toxic masculinity, especially in Hollywood, and these men taking advantage of their powerful positions, right? And I remember seeing all of those and thinking, I want some more context, because I've seen some interviews where Blake doesn't appear to be the nicest. And, you know, there's all this like allegation of a smear campaign and this and that. And I really wanted to have both sides of the story. And I'm so glad that I waited to speak on this until I did, because this is just crazy. We're only like halfway through, if that, you guys. I wrote 20 pages. I'm only on page 13. So we've got a ways to go. But on May 29th, Wayfarer Production was made aware that Blake had placed a call to the film's Sony executive to share a few grievances. One was Justin Baldoni's sexy comment about the wardrobe of her character, Lily, which, as previously contextualized, was benign and mischaracterized by Blake, who took the comment personally. And then number two was that Jamie Heath showed her this post-home birth video. She's complaining about that. And then number three was that Blake shared her grievances about the first AD or assistant director, suggesting that she be replaced. She and the second AD, who was also a woman, were also shortly thereafter let go. I don't know why she wanted them fired, but in the text after the AD was let go, Jamie and Justin both expressed disappointment that they had to let her go. And at this point, it seems very clear that Blake is really driving this car, and the director of the film, Justin, is just a passenger at this point. Like, throughout this entire thing, you guys, you have to remember Justin is the freaking director. This would be like an employee or like a C-level employee going to the CEO and demanding to do their job. Like, that is just not something that happens. Okay. So June 14th, Justin texts his production team that Blake wants to see the dailies. Now, the dailies are basically everything that is recorded. Okay. So like there's multiple takes of each scene. The dailies are basically all of those. Okay. They want to see the whole kit and caboodle. Concerned about Blake's tendency to overstep and take control, Justin consulted his producing team on how best to respond. Now, the team unanimously advised against granting her access, fearing that she might start to edit the movie and dictate which takes to use, which is foreshadowing, a concern that ultimately proved to be accurate. However, as a gesture of goodwill, Justin chose to compromise by sending her a curated 5-hour playlist instead. So after this, the production was halted because of the writer's strike, and the picketers for the strike were making it impossible to film because they were outside chanting and hollering all the time. So the decision was made to temporarily pause production, and that decision was announced on June 14th. The next day, picketers said that they would not picket near their set so that they could resume filming. But at that point, Blake had already decided to leave and join Ryan in London. Now, despite them letting her know that they could continue filming until the 23rd, like they had originally planned, she refused to return. So this meant that they had to use those days to shoot scenes that Blake was not in. But imagine the reorganization that that would require. Like, literally everyone has to work around this diva, this, you know, A-list whatever star of the movie. She thinks that she is the most important person in this entire movie. Now, in July, phase one of filming had completed, and Blake texted Justin asking for more of the dailies. He had given her, reluctantly, that 5-hour playlist of the dailies, but she wanted more. Now, obviously, given how controlling she is, he was reluctant to share the dailies with her, but he's also tiptoeing with her because he knows if he sets her off, it's going to create more problems. Because at this point, what can they do? They can't recast her. It's going to cost them millions of dollars. They've already done so much as far as like writing the script and the production and getting all these other characters and cast members and the costume and everything. Like, they can't just recast her. But they also worry that if they piss her off, she's not going to promote the film, which is something that she does hang over their head later. So Justin tells her at this point, in part, "It's too early for me to share all the dailies." And she responds, quote, "None of the producers have had access to the dailies. It's just you?" Question mark. Now, it should come as no surprise that when Blake didn't get her way, she had her attorney send the following email. On November 9th, on the very day the SAG-AFTRA strike ended, Justin, the studio, and the producers were eager to resume production. However, their plans were disrupted by this unexpected email from Blake's lawyer. The email contained a 17-point list of non-negotiable conditions that Blake demanded be met before her return to work. The list, both in tone and content, appeared to insinuate or outright allege that Justin, Jamie Heath, and others had engaged in sexually inappropriate conduct during the film, and the demand was that if they did not sign this, she would not continue filming, and there was no way they could just replace her, obviously. But the list included things like no personal touching or sexual comments from Justin or Heath without consent, no more improvising kissing, an intimacy coordinator for all scenes with nudity or simulated sex, no friends of the producers and directors on set during scenes with Blake and Justin. Justin and Jamie Heath should not describe their own genitalia. Like, okay, so naturally, if they sign this, then it looks like they're agreeing that these things have happened and won't happen again, right? Now, after this, there were more scheduling conflicts because of Blake, and it seemed like after the list of demands, Justin just kind of waved the white flag and gave up. So he sent the following email to his team on December 27th. He said, quote, "Hey team, attached is a revised script with the below notes and caveats in bold. This is not final as there are things we need to discuss and implement. I've spent the better part of the last few days trying to figure this out. Everyone knows how I feel about all this and how angry I am that Blake has taken over our film and somehow rewrote a movie we spent years developing, writing, and funding. So yes, I am furious and sad, but I will continue to get back up with the goal of getting us to the finish line. I've come to terms with the fact that the only way out is through. I'm waving the white flag and submitting. I'm going to give her 98% of what she wants. I'm sure none of us have the energy to fight anymore. The team who has been working their ass off needs a shooting script on January 2nd. So here's where we are. And he says the big issues are going to be intimacy, how and what we are shooting for those scenes, and how the script is going to be presented to her and with what notes. To that end, we all need to get on the phone and talk through it, as the risk of something innocuous or not meeting her standards could and very would likely be used against me, as it already has. And creativity is impossible in an environment shrouded in fear. By now, we all know what she is capable of. And that email was sent to the entire production team, excluding Blake, obviously, because she's not part of the production team. She doesn't leverage that position until later. But on January 4th, Baldoni Heath, a Sony executive, a producer, the A-list producer, and the film's first AD, met at Blake's and Ryan Reynolds' New York apartment ahead of the scheduled production restart on January 4th. Now, the team arrived prepared with production binders in hand, eager to kick off the next phase of filming. However, Blake had different intentions for this meeting. She began by reading from notes on her phone, outlining a series of alleged infractions from phase one, and then Ryan Reynolds berated Justin Baldoni, demanding that he apologize to Blake for actions that had either never occurred or had been grossly mischaracterized. Justin resisted apologizing for the things that he did not do, which further enraged Ryan Reynolds. Everyone, including the new producer that Lively had requested to join the production and the Sony representative, left the meeting in shock. The new A-list producer remarked that in their 40-year career, they had never seen anyone spoken to in such a manner during a meeting. And later, the Sony representative shared that they often reflected on the meeting and regretted not intervening to stop Ryan's tirade against Justin. Filming finished early in February, and then it was time to start editing. And as the director, Justin started editing on February 22nd. 2 days later, Blake makes demands to Sony that she join the editors for the editing process before she leaves to film her next movie in April. And she makes sure to note that if she can't help edit, then she can't promise to promote it. She keeps pushing and pushing for more control, and finally, on April 3rd, she makes the demand that she wants to edit the movie by herself with her own editor, and she has made it clear that she will not promote the film unless this demand is met. This, my friends, is the definition of extortion. So at this point, Sony has to get involved, and they remind her that the only people who are allowed to access the editing room are Wayfair, because they are the producers of the movie, not Sony. This next detail is actually really sad when you consider the history of this entire production, dating back to 2019 with Justin when he got the rights to create the film adaptation of the book. On April 30th, Jamie Heath is informed that Blake told the Sony marketing team that she wants Justin's name off of anything that also has her name, and also demanded that Justin's film buy credit is removed from any posters. So on any of the posters, sometimes you see various actors' names at the top, right? Well, it would have said Blake Lively, Justin Baldoni at the top. She was demanding that it only say Blake Lively, and that a film by Justin Baldoni be nowhere on the poster. There is no creative or professional justification for his name to be excluded. It is purely a result of her demands. And then she doubles down and says she might change her mind about reaching out to Taylor Swift to secure the use of her song My Tears Ricochet for the trailer if her demands are not met. In May, Blake refuses to turn over her cut to the film's director and instead tells Sony that she wants to do a friends and family screening of her cut to gather feedback and continue working on her edit. Now, this was, of course, at Wayfair and Sony's expense, but not accounted for in the budget. So Sony and Wayfair do an official audience test screening of Justin Baldoni's cut, and the film scores 94% with females under 35, which is the film's primary target audience that I talked about in the very beginning. Remember, the book was marketed and made for women under 35. That's their target audience. So Justin's score is 94%. Both Sony and Wayfarer are super ecstatic about this score. And meanwhile, Blake is still pushing her cut of the film and has Sony tell the editors that they are not permitted to look at her cut of the film. I'm sorry, but like, it's laughable at this point. Around that same time, Blake holds a friends and family preview in New York. So the director and editors of the actual film aren't allowed to see it, but her friends are. And I can assume who the friends are based on the special thanks and the credits. So there's like Bradley Cooper, of course, Taylor Swift and Austin Swift are also in the credits. Maybe they came and saw it as well. But apparently she's so emboldened by the feedback that she got from her biased friends and family that she decides to hold an official screen test under the understanding that if her version of the film scores lower than Justin's, then she will drop the whole matter and cooperate so that Justin could finish the film and we could all just move on. So she holds the screening. You guys, her film scored 82%, significantly lower than Justin's, which was 94%. Even though she promised to drop it and cooperate if she scored lower, do you think she did? Of course not. She still demanded that her cut be chosen over Justin's, and she threatened to not promote the movie if they don't use hers. And then she doubles down and says that Colleen Hoover would also refuse to promote the film unless Blake's cut was used. In June, Justin finds out that Blake would be going to Book Bonanza with Colleen Hoover instead of Justin. Now, for context, Book Bonanza is an event that was created by Colleen Hoover to promote authors, but also give readers a chance to meet their favorite authors. It's like this big convention. And obviously, Colleen has a huge fan base. But to originally intend to have Justin there, only to then uninvite Justin and bring Blake instead, feels like this very childish and petty move, and is yet another example of Blake exerting control and power over Justin, and now maybe even Colleen, who seems to be joining Team Blake, if you will. Oh, and not only that, but Blake informs Wayfarer and Sony that she will be showing her cut of the film to everyone at Book Bonanza, whether they like it or not. And meanwhile, Justin still was not allowed to see her cut. And yet his name is going to be on the film as the director. Like, wrap your mind around that, you guys. It's insane. All right. Now, we are almost to the end, but in June 20th to the 24th, Jennifer Abel, who is Justin Baldoni's publicist, emails Sony's marketing team to inquire about a content shoot that Blake Lively seemingly coordinated with Maximum Effort, which is a production company owned by Ryan Reynolds. Now, Sony at the time of the initial outreach by Abel was not aware of the plans for the shoot, which were planned for June 27th to the 28th. And apparently this content shoot was put together by Blake and Ryan. And of course, Justin was not invited, but other cast members were. And it was this whole curated shoot to have the cast baking cookies together and making drinks together with Blake's alcohol line and doing other things like sewing patches onto jeans, like, I don't know, completely forgetting the whole purpose behind this movie and book, which is that it centers around the theme of domestic violence, but they're all arranging flowers, they're baking cookies together, and they're patchworking jeans. Like, I can't. But anyway, Justin was not even invited, so Jennifer is reaching out to be like, what is going on? If this is happening, Justin needs to be a part of it, or people are going to start noticing that he's not a part of these content shoots, and they're going to start talking about it because it's pretty obvious, right? Well, later, Sony attested to the fact that Blake and Ryan Reynolds were, quote, running the show, end quote. So Jennifer Abel was understandably concerned at the optics of the entire cast doing a content shoot without the director and the co-lead. I keep forgetting, he's not only the director, he is the co-lead, right? So this would later be something that the public would take notice of as well, and only heightened the rumors and the negative press that Blake would ultimately take issue with and blame Justin for, but she truly created this whole mess by herself. While this whole thing is going on too, there are two things that are simultaneously being held over everyone's head, okay? So there is a contract, this like acting contract that apparently Blake had never signed, okay? And she needed to sign it to ensure that she would promote the movie once it was finished. There was also on Blake's end, so like that was kind of the card that the production team was holding. Well, on the other hand, Blake is holding this card that she wants Justin and Jamie Heath to write a letter of recommendation to the PGA on behalf of Blake Lively and send a copy to Blake Lively to submit the PGA. And this is essentially to give her that PGA mark behind her name as part of the Producers Guild, I think, of America. It's like a prestigious
you know, title to have associated with your name. And so she's saying with all the work that she's done on this film, she deserves to have the PGA on her name, but she has to have a recommendation for that. And Jamie Heath, who has the PGA on his name and who is a member of Wayfarer Production, and so is Justin, they're like, okay, well, do we need to concede and write this letter of recommendation? Or what is she going to do if we don't, right? So at first they're like, no, we can't in good faith write that recommendation because, you know, that's not what you were brought onto the film to do, right? And so then she starts doing all this shady stuff behind the scenes. She says all goodwill and good faith is lost. And then they, you know, start to get worried and they feel like they're trapped, Justin and Jamie. So then they reluctantly write this letter recommending that she receive the PGA title to her name. And then the very same day, Jamie Heath simultaneously wrote a letter to his attorneys deriding the extortion by Blake Lively. So again, Blake Lively gets what she wants because she's a spoiled little brat. Despite getting what she wants, though, on July 15th, Wayfarer was informed that Ryan Reynolds contacted Justin Baldoni's personal agent at WME. And during the call, Ryan Reynolds escalates his attack on Justin's character, calling him a deranged predator. Okay. Justin's agent relays to Wayfarer that he did his best to reason with Ryan Reynolds and challenge these absurd claims, but Ryan Reynolds was unwilling to consider any counter-narrative, and he reiterated that Justin should not attend the premiere on August 6th, stating no one wants him there. So on August 6th, at the premiere of the film in New York, Justin Baldoni is instructed to walk the carpet separately from the rest of the cast. However, he is quickly ushered off to the press line when it is announced that Blake and her, you know, team is on her way. And once inside the theater lobby, security escorts Justin and his family to the basement to prevent a potential encounter with Blake and the cast. Of course, social media recognized this, and they began to notice an online sleuth find that the cast is also unfollowing Justin. Then, during another red carpet interview on August 9th, at the New York premiere, Blake Lively stated, quote, "The iconic rooftop scene, my husband actually wrote it. Nobody knows that," end quote. Well, this revelation regarding Reynolds' purported contribution to the script raised eyebrows at Sony, who told Wayfarer that they certainly needed some clarification and clarity on the public comments made about Ryan Reynolds potentially contributing writing services for the rooftop scene, because he was never contracted to do that. But then that begs the question, who was ultimately behind this entire power tirade in the first place? Was it Blake? Was it Ryan? Was it both of them? In my opinion, I think it was both of them. And then it gets better. On August 12th, WME, Jennifer Abel, and Jamie Heath discuss yet another conversation between WME and Ryan Reynolds. And WME is the talent agency, I believe, that represents both Ryan and Justin and Blake, I think. But WME shares that Ryan and Blake are furious with Wayfarer and Justin for positioning them as promoting the film as a Barbie film while elevating Justin to speak on the more serious messaging. So Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively purportedly believed that Justin's team was responsible for this positioning and demand that Wayfarer release a statement of contrition, taking accountability for the negative press towards Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds. They warn WME that absent compliance, quote, "the gloves will come off," end quote. So in turn, Ryan Reynolds tells WME that he would personally draft a statement for Wayfarer to release immediately. Jamie Heath and Jennifer Abel are astounded that Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively blame Justin Baldoni and Wayfarer for their own self-inflicted PR nightmare. And this is hilarious. Ryan Reynolds wrote this as a statement that he expected Wayfarer and Justin Baldoni to release. And it says, quote, "It Ends With Us was a troubled production, which we take full accountability for. We are very sorry to everyone we caused upset to privately and publicly. Blake Lively, Colleen Hoover, the entire cast and crew led with professionalism every step of the way. Any negativity aimed at them is ours to own. We mutually agreed that the cast would be promoting the film separately and understood why. We have always said we are not perfect, and even if unintentionally make mistakes, we will always own them. We hold ourselves accountable. It's not anyone's job but ours, and that's part of being, quote, man enough. We will practice what we preach. We are learning and growing from the experience, and we thank everyone for their patience as we find a better way to proceed. We are very proud of the film and the welcome arms that it has been received. Part of our work is to have uncomfortable conversations for public growth. The film is doing that on screen, and we are doing that off screen. Thank you to the cast and crew and public for the opportunity to be imperfect and to be given the space to learn and grow with humanity and dedication. And then it's left unsigned because it was assumed that Justin and Jamie would sign it. Let's point out a few things here, okay? Oh my gosh. First of all, to say Blake Lively, Colleen Hoover, the entire cast and crew led with professionalism every step of the way. Any negativity aimed at them is ours to own is unreal. Because think about what the public is seeing. They're seeing this dichotomous promotion of the movie where some people seem to be taking it very seriously and some people don't. But behind the scenes, you know that Blake is literally driving this bus and making all these decisions and excluding Justin on purpose. So to like acknowledge that there could have been any unprofessionalism or any negativity, and yet they see that and they're refusing to own it is just chef's kiss irony. But oh my God, Ryan Reynolds saying that's part of being, quote, man enough, poking fun and mocking at Justin's entire brand, which is his podcast, his book, his entire brand, is really, really insulting. But I also love the end, the sign off with humanity and dedication. I think he meant humility. But anyway, this just screams Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively all over it. Like they're completely wiping their hands and absolving themselves of literally any responsibility whatsoever. Literally just taking a page out of Narcissism 101. But thankfully, in response, Wayfarer, Justin, and Jamie Heath rejected the demand, firmly refusing to issue any statement, falsely assuming responsibility for non-existent issues. Thankfully, I was like, when I finally saw that, I was like, thank God, you're finally standing up for yourself. You know, like I just have seen him get steamrolled throughout this whole thing over and over again. And this nice guy, nice pool, which we'll get to that in part two. But it's just like, finally, I've been wanting to see this guy stand up for himself. So that was a refreshing thing to see. But after the film comes out, people start talking about what they're noticing online. They start, you know, talking amongst each other that there seems to be a feud among the cast, or at least between Justin and Blake. And Blake's team starts trying to pin it on Justin and Justin's publicity team. And we see in this whole smear campaign piece that she put out on the New York Times and everything else that they included these screenshots, okay, where it seemed like Jennifer Abel, who is Justin Baldoni's publicist, said in a text message regarding this article that was released to, I think, the Daily Mail, the title of the article was, "Could Blake Lively Be Canceled?" And in the text, Jennifer Abel says, "Wow, you really outdid yourself with this piece," right? As if they're taking ownership for this piece hitting the media and, you know, they're doing their job, okay? Well, what's omitted from those screenshots, and this is why context matters. If you look at the entire conversation, Justin Baldoni asks Melissa Nathan, who is working in tandem with Jennifer Abel, his publicist, Justin asks Melissa to confirm, "This is not us, correct?" with the link. And Justin was seeing these feud rumors and could not believe how much heat Blake Lively was getting because his position was always to be reactionary. He did not want to start bad press for Blake. He just knew that if Blake was going to say something about Justin, he wanted to be prepared, right? So it was always his position to be reactionary. Melissa responds to Justin saying, "None of us would ever do this." And there is the struggle where it's kind of maybe even unbelievable the way that people are turning against her. It was organic. She's blown herself up by her own actions. End quote. That is what Melissa Nathan says to Jennifer or to Justin. Then in a separate text with Melissa and Jen, Melissa says in response to that article, "Damn, this is unfair because it's also not me. Everything now looks like it's me. Maybe not to you, And this reporter says, no, it totally does look like his side is, you know, pushing this narrative out. And so she texts Jen, you know, saying these things like that it looks like she wrote it, but she really didn't. And so Jennifer responds saying, wow, you really outdid yourself with this piece, with an upside down smiley face. And so they're being sarcastic, but Blake's team, her legal team, omitted the smiley face and then omitted all the other conversation. So all it says, all you see is, wow, you really outdid yourself with this piece, making it look like his publicity team is the one that planted that story. All of this is included in Blake Lively's complaint that she filed with the California Civil Rights Department on December 20th of 2024. And that same day, Megan Toohey, who was a reporter for the New York Times, reached out to Wayfair about allegations made by Blake Lively related to that CRD complaint, saying, please offer any on-the-record comment as well as any other information you think we should know. Additionally, please notify us of any inaccuracies. We need to hear back from you by tomorrow at noon Eastern. Then December 21st, the next day at 10 a.m. Eastern time, almost 2 hours before the deadline given by Toohey for the plaintiff's response, the Times published that article entitled, We Can Bury Anyone Inside a Hollywood Smear Campaign. It's all published without a paywall, which is atypical for New York Times. Usually they make you pay to read their articles, but it was not behind a paywall, and the entire lawsuit was available for download. December 31st, Justin Baldoni and his team filed the lawsuit against the New York Times. And then December 31st, Lively also files a lawsuit against Justin Baldoni and his team. January 7th, Blake attempts to serve Baldoni and his team during the LA wildfires, going as far as to serve a member of Justin's team while they were attempting to evacuate with their small child. January 16th, Justin and his team filed suit against Blake Lively, Reynolds, Sloan, and Vision PR. And then January 24th, discovery is made, and that main imagery used in the article, it's revealed that there was metadata creation timestamps days prior to the publication. So this is pretty interesting because the pictures and the media that they used for the New York Times article, some internet sleuth, I don't know who it was, I think it might have been someone on TikTok, but some internet sleuth found that if you right-clicked an image, it would show you how New York Times stored that image, and it was predated back to December 12th, long before this article and everything came out, meaning they were all colluding together to publish this piece. And the fact that they only gave Justin and his team such a small window of time to respond, and then published it before the deadline was even over, was obviously going to be included in this lawsuit. So, oh my God, you guys, I'm freaking tired. I need to drink some water, and there's still so much to talk about. So I'm going to end this episode here, and we're going to come back for part two to talk about Taylor Swift's involvement, Ryan Reynolds and his Deadpool nice pool shit that he did against Justin. Like, it's so petty and mean, but I think we need to call it out, because if there's anything that I definitely do stand for, it is calling out bad behavior when I see it. And time is up. I don't like seeing people take advantage of nice people. And that is what I feel is being done here. I think Blake Lively has proven.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
Over and over again, prior to ever meeting Justin Baldoni, that she is not a nice person and that she doesn't always act in good faith. And so I feel like they completely steamrolled and took advantage of Justin Baldoni's niceness. And because he was such a patient and empathetic, sympathetic person, it has now gotten to this point. But I'm really relieved to see that the public, or social media at least, seems to really be rallying for Justin Baldoni. I also want to touch on Colleen Hoover's involvement in all of this. because I think the way that she has acted is really disappointing as well. So part two will be that. I'm going to bring back Daisy Fresh. You guys loved it when I had her on my episode about Hana Kobayashi. She's going to come back and we're going to talk about all the other stuff together because it should hopefully not be an hour and a half long episode like this one is. But anyway, that is all I have for you today. Stay tuned for part two. Thank you so much for listening to Mama Mystery. Tell me what you think about this deep dive. If it made sense, if you're with me, if I'm missing anything, please let me know. You can message me on Instagram at mama.mysterypodcast, or you can go to mamamystery.com, scroll down to that box and write me a message anytime, day or night. Love you all. Thank you so much. Mama Mystery out.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.